to the All Flesh podcast, NoShip Network's coverage of Hulu's television series, The Handmaid's Tale. Tonight, we are discussing Season 2, Episode 13, the season finale, also known as The Word. This episode was written by Bruce Miller and directed by Mike Barker. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Where to begin? What to say? Honestly, aside from the last 3 or 4 minutes, this was a great, great episode. Lots of good stuff happened in there. They even managed to squeeze in a little bit of humor. Commander Lawrence had me laughing out loud at one point, just from the little stuff that he said. There was some comeuppance. There was some drama. There was a whole lot of tension. There was everything that makes a great episode of Handmaid's Tale, whatever makes it great.
But, or any television show. I mean, that.
Yeah.
It was masterful as far as how they at least made me respond physically to what I was watching, because it was almost like I was having an epileptic fit.
You were. We watched this on the bed and you were like kicking and going, no, go.
Yeah, and doing yelling and all kinds of stuff.
Punching the pillows. It was the cats got scared. It was a ruckus. Quite a ruckus was stirred with emotions.
I had one of my cats look at me wide eyed for a few minutes.
Who is this person?
What's her deal?
So I guess we can kind of deal with the end when we get to the end. But I would say that overall, that 98% of this episode suited me just fine. I am firmly in the camp of people who thinks that the ending is not to their satisfaction. So we'll. What did you think?
Well, this is definitely an episode that you need to watch more than once. And also talk to other people about it and get some other opinions. I will say that my initial response was rage.
Yeah.
But after talking to some people, especially people who are parents, that gave me some perspective that I don't have. We'll get into that a little bit as we discuss the recap. But overall, I feel a little bit better about it. I just don't want to see the same old next season. I really feel like we kind of hung around in the hamster wheel a little bit too long here, and I don't want to see it anymore.
Agreed. Shall we get into recap?
Yes. All right. This episode opens with contemplation over Eden's untimely death. Specifically, June and Rita are lovingly gathering her items, laundering her items. I'm assuming this is to give to Eden's father when he arrives.
That's what I surmise as well, yeah.
Rita regrets her treatment towards Eden.
I really like this scene because I felt like it was honest and I felt like it was natural. That's what you would be thinking. That's what everybody recriminates themselves when somebody close to them dies, even if they were completely on the level and cool with that person, which Rita was not with Eden, of course. But even if you were, you still feel like, geez, I wish that things A, B, and C could have happened, or I could have told them this or told them that or treated them better, whatever have you. And so that really struck me as real.
And I think she's speaking also for a lot of Handmaid's Tale fans, because a lot of people didn't feel warm towards Eden for a long period.
Yeah.
And so Rita, in a way, is speaking for those of us who felt along those lines. That said, I really wish we had more of Eden to make us more attached to her. And I think they could have really done more with her, especially now that we know she was reading a Bible and writing in the Bible, and she had encountered those letters that Nick had. And maybe there could have been more to that. And maybe that it could have linked up to her passion towards Isaac. Or, you know, just something there that...
Agency Eden looks like she could have been a really cool character, but we got kind of robbed of that. And we were only in hindsight, posthumously, is she a cool character? You know, the last 5 minutes that she has on screen made you like her. And then now afterwards and forevermore, everybody's going to look back on her and say, you know, so whenever people go back and binge the second season to get ready for the third or whatever, it's going to be a totally different look. It'll be interesting to get people's opinions to see how when they go through and rewatch it. Because I don't think anybody's going to be rewatching it anytime soon, because this was... it's such a cliche thing to say, but an emotional roller coaster. And now that it's over, I think we're all going to be okay with getting off for a little while. You know,
we're as viewers, we're in league with the oppressed, with Rita, June, Emily, Janine. So when you have a character like Eden who's happily chugging the Kool-Aid,
right?
There's a line that's drawn in the sand there. So she becomes annoying to them and as well as to us. And I mean, the show purposely set that up just like they did with Commander Lawrence. And I have to give my apology to Commander Lawrence because I was sure he was evil but more on that later. But anyway, I guess I'm just rambling here too much, but it's interesting how she was somebody who was set up to be annoying, not just to us, but also to our favorite characters in the show, and how she ends up being a catalyst for all of them in the end, and how they feel that her death was a tragedy, because it doesn't matter if you play the game, you're still doomed.
Yeah, Gilead is a rotten system, and you can play by all of the rules, but it's set up for a bunch of insecure men to feel like they have control of stuff. I mean, all of them are a similar stripe to what Waterford is, and they all have these massive insecurities that drove them to want to have this society where they had to be the ultimate authority, that everybody was going to listen to them. And when you have that kind of society, nobody has a chance. Even the people who are following the rules and trying to do the right thing, they're going to get screwed over too.
So after Rita has exited the kitchen and June's still looking through Eden's items, she discovers that Bible I've already mentioned and sees that Eden had written inside of it. So she immediately takes this Bible to Serena. And Serena's first reaction to it is to say, it seems like Eden was hiding a multitude of sins, which is curious to me because I imagine pre-Gilead, Serena had her own copy that was dog-eared and written all in the margins.
Yeah. So she's double dipping right here as far as quote unquote sins are concerned, because not only does she have reading material, even if it is the Bible, she's also writing in it. So she's writing and reading. So I think those are two like distinct punishable sins, aren't they? I don't know if they would lump them together. They'd be like, hey, you had a pen and you were doing you and you were reading stuff. So we're going to get you coming and going. So that was the handmaids in the group call her brave later on, and it's true. She is brave for doing this, but I think she probably didn't have as much of a care about how brave she was being, but rather like there's this earnestness, this honestness to really like live by the, you know, what was being set forth in the Bible, but to understand it as well so you could do it to your utmost, mm-hmm. so you could process it and everything. Because it's one thing for somebody to tell you to do something and then to just follow that rule. It's another completely different experience altogether to read it, to understand it for yourself.
Have a passion for it.
Yeah, have a passion. And you can't have the passion for it if you can't even access the material. Mm-hmm. So
it just seems to me that Serena would actually connect to Eden more seeing that, because she felt already like they were kindred spirits, I think.
Yeah.
And so I had, upon first viewing, just a total eye roll moment here, because I just felt like, oh, great, here we go again, another about face with Serena. After we ended last episode with her talking about contending with thee and thou or whatever, yeah. I don't remember the quote, sorry. But you know what I mean? Like, it's like, really? We're doing this again?
Well, they play with your emotions on that one, because Serena really is a pendulum. Every time you think that she's going to go so far in one direction and just kind of break and stay there. Have that, you know, because there's been a lot of straws that have broke that we thought were going to break her back throughout the time, you know, like little things during the beginning of the season and even a little bit last season. And then you think like, okay, what happens to her at this point is going to do it. Nope. Then at this point, okay, what about when Fred comes back home from healing up from the hospital after the attack, and he takes away her crayons and paper and she can't, you know,
and whips her.
I was dealing with him separately though. Like, you know, the first that was bad enough that he was just like, okay, now get out. I don't need your help anymore. You help pat on the head, totally condescending. Then the next day he's whipping her. Then after that, you see Eden die. Then after that, you know, you have this breakthrough with June. And then it takes finally for her to have physical, you know, can't come back from this like mutilation of her actual body that they went through with it and did it. That was finally the thing. All this other stuff, just she was able to get over it somehow and go back to her Serena Gilead personality rather than her Serena normal human being personality that June was able to break through to on occasion. So we kept thinking that would be all the straws, and finally, you know, so they're playing on our frustrations that not even Eden's death had finally brought her over and kept her there. But she brings up a really good, or June really brings up a good point about the whole, in this scene when she's talking about, like, how are you going to take care of my daughter and, or your daughter? Which I thought it was really impressive of her to say it that way. How are you going to take care of your daughter? Because you can't, anybody can follow rules, but if those rules are always changing and they're at the whims of somebody else, then she can't even read the Bible. You know, Serena's talking about how she's going to grow up and be a woman of God and do what God says and everything. Well, how is she supposed to know what that is? Is Fred going to tell her? Well, if on Tuesday, Fred feels like this is a good idea, and then on Thursday, he feels like something else is a better idea, then he's going to tell her whatever she wants. And how will they know? That kind of complete control, there's no, you lose all kinds of checks and balances, because then not everybody is subject to the same law, because only some people know it.
So, right, yeah. And that's June's point.
Yeah.
And that's a control. That's and we've been throughout, you know, season one and up until now, that the it's not just control of the bodies, it's control of the mind and removal of access of truth.
Yeah, there's no absolutes in a society like this, because it would be bad enough to live in a theocratic society like that, where even if they wrote it all on a big wall and everybody could look at all the rules, it would be bad enough to have to do that, all the bullshit you'd have to go through. But then this society even takes that away from you, and now it's just in the male's heads or material that they can access. So you don't even know what the rules are till you break some of them. You're going to be told what some of them are, but there's going to be others that you don't know. And if they want to change them, if they want to apply them in an unbalanced fashion, who can stop them? There's no, so that just becomes the worst possible case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, at some point they can just make it up out of a whole cloth according to what they want to mandate.
And human nature pretty much dictates that they will at some point start doing mm-hmm. that.
And as Serena often does when she doesn't have a good response to something that's reasonable, she tells her to get out.
Serena's old standby, get out, go to your room.
June slowly exits, leaving Serena with the Bible. Now, June and Rita stand in the Waterford receiving room, witnessing the conversation between Eden's father and the Waterfords. Commander Waterford's anger towards Eden is cold and unrelenting. He does not hide this for Eden's father's benefit, not for one second. Serena is kinder. And it turns out Eden's parents turned her in. Commander Waterford is impressed with the family's loyalty.
So the two things that struck me about this scene is that there's like two different things going on at the same time. And I thought it was one of the better scenes of the episode as far as like the message being put forth. But anyway, it's kind of like, on one hand, you have the differences between Fred and Serena handling this discussion. Serena's trying to, as you said, be sympathizing and kind of put it in the best light possible and bring forth, like, she always talked about you guys. She loved you. She loved the farm. She was I believe that she was a good person, and so on and so forth. And he deals with her in a certain level, but then he's kowtowing totally to Commander Waterford, because that's his social superior in this situation, and he's talking about, you know, how much faith he has and stuff. And so you've got the two different conversations and the two ways that that's being handled, that information. And then that's when June makes that connection with Serena, and I think that's where it really clicks for her, because she's like looking at her, like, when she's like, this is what's happening to people who are being raised in this society.
Right.
You've got this kid now. And so that's, I think that's when the light bulb goes on and she's like, fuck, I have to do something.
Yeah. I also think she was getting to that even before the look between June, because I think the fact that she was able to sympathize with Eden's father is because she doesn't believe herself to be beyond reproach like the commander does. The fact that he can act like all high and mighty like he does, is he does not see himself in Eden's father's shoes the way Serena does. And that's why Serena is being kinder, because she can imagine herself there, because she already has. She did last episode, and she also did it with June in the greenhouse.
Okay, that's a really good point. That makes, yeah, so the look between them was more solidifying than a genesis. She was already thinking that. Yeah, you're right. Like, looking back at it now, she was, because it is about empathy. Yeah, it is. Okay. That's a better way to look at it, because I was just kind of looking at it like, okay, this is where she's coming up with this idea. I better act on June's tip, you know, or for lack of a better term. But I think you're right. It's totally about the empathy that she's feeling.
When everyone has exited the room, with exception of Commander Waterford, June turns around and asks him, what are you going to do when they come for your daughter?
Ooh.
Which is a question he needs to be asked, mm-hmm. because clearly he's not seeing himself in that position.
I mean, just take the what happened to Commander Cushing. All it takes is a little bit of maneuvering from a well-placed guardian and a smart, resourceful wife in this society, and you're put behind bars and or hung on the wall or whatever happened to this guy for something that you didn't actually do. I mean, he was guilty of being a dickhead, but he wasn't guilty of what they said he did, but they got him for it. And so Commander Waterford doesn't seem to think that he's ever going to end up there. But June sees through all that bullshit. She's like, none of that bravado and ego plays with me. I'm worried about my kids. So what's going to happen when it's your turn in the hot seat?
Well, I mean, a better comparison would actually be Commander Putnam, who was punished for behavior that Commander Waterford does actually perform. He is obsessed with June. He treats her inappropriately, and he could potentially be in the same hot water that Commander Putnam was in. But yet he still acts like he is somehow above it all.
Yeah, and he would, for the stuff that he's done, they would be lucky if they just came for his hand, like what they did with Putnam. Because they would come and they would take the rest of his family away and say, you're not fit to have all of this. You're going to be stripped of rank. You're not going to have a wife. We're going to take away this child, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
So he walks towards the door and you think he's just going to exit without any comment. But then he closes it slowly and walks back over to June, telling her to mind her tongue. He then smacks her hard across the face. She smacks him back. That was just... That moment, the first time you see that, is just like, oh my God. I think I clapped both my hands over my face or over my mouth.
I've been waiting for this moment all my life. I loved it. I love that. It was the perfect, the way his hair falls out of place and everything too. It's just, it's such a great scene.
And he grabs her by the face and forces her down onto that couch or settee, however you say that.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I've only ever read it. I've never heard it said out loud. And he says, the mouth of a woman is a deep pit. He that falls therein will suffer. You are the misery of all man, all of you. And that is a variation on Proverbs 22:14. And then there's also many translations depending on which Bible you're reading it from, but the New International Version, it's the mouth of an adulterous woman is a deep pit. A man who is under the Lord's wrath falls into it.
Hmm.
And it seems like he just fails to recognize that the type of man who would fall into it would be one who has angered his Lord. So he just chooses to ignore that part of the proverb.
Which is typical.
He's already rewriting the Bible.
Yeah, it's so typical to just go around and take, you know, you're just being, you're doing the buffet, as they say. You take away what you want from it, but you don't take the whole thing with its full intended meaning. And once again, I think this goes back down to the insecurities of stuff. Fred doesn't want to deal with women as equals. He only wants to deal with women when he's in a position of power. This much is obvious. This is no great revelation or insight to anybody, but it really comes through in scenes like this when he's blaming women for being, you know, and then later on, you know, being disobedient and this way and that way, like they are all supposed to have to fill out these roles for him, to make him feel comfortable because he can't function if he has to deal with that. He's emasculated in some way. If a woman is smarter than him, has become more successful than him, is more effective at anything than him. And that's just the most miserable way to be in the world. But hey, that's Fred's life.
Yeah, and it just takes it home if you actually look up what the real quote is or the real sentiment behind the quote, because his is definitely a twisted, as if he's just only a victim, not somebody who has angered his Lord. Well, I really like how they had him say that, because hopefully most viewers went and looked it up and saw how that actually fit into the title and what the thrust of this episode, especially with in regards to Serena, what can happen if you don't have that ability to seek out the truth yourself.
Amen.
Lately, I've been having a lot of conversations with someone who's from China. Their media is heavily limited and lots of propaganda. And she was telling me how shocked she was when she moved to the United States and found out that the Dalai Lama was not a bad guy.
It's just what, you know, it's just amazing what you take for granted when you live in a free society. You don't really think about it that much in the actual, like, examples of it. I mean, you're always trying to defend freedom in some small way that you can do to contribute, like voting or protesting or whatever it is that you just, or just even reading a book these days. But you, when you think about what it's like, specific examples of having that freedom deprived from you, and freedom of information is one of the biggest ones that there can be. And so that's crazy.
After this encounter with the commander, an impressed Rita gives June some ice for her bruised face. June says she thinks she broke her hand, and Rita says, praise be.
And she means it. I think that's probably the first time that she said praise be, and she means it.
So Nick enters the picture and we get a moment where Nick gets to hold the baby. Rita watches and June tells Nick she loves him. Before, you know, though, Nick entered the picture, Rita had to leave the room because she had to go deal with her Royal Highness, the baby.
Yeah.
And I started laughing during my third viewing because I was thinking, you know what? That was probably when Rita was like, you know, I'm going to get June and the baby out of this house because I am tired of being the one at this baby's beck and call.
This is an elaborate ploy by Rita, the head Martha, to just get, you know, she's running things with all of this. And she's just like, I need this baby out of the house.
But in reality, it's more of just all the events that have come to this point where not only with Eden dying and then seeing Nick and June together. And also, I think she probably felt June deserved it after smacking the shit out of Commander Waterford.
Well, hey, you know, she, like, Rita couldn't smack Serena back. So if she knows that at least Fred got smacked, there's a little bit of consolation prize there. I like this scene because she says, June says, this is Holly. And she said she introduces Holly to her daddy. And this is a nice counterpoint to the previous episode where, I think it was a previous episode anyway, where you have Fred introducing, you know, Nicole to Offred. So I thought that was kind of a point-counterpoint thing.
Yeah, I like that. So the following scene, we have June, Emily, Janine, and Fourth Wheel.
Fourth Wheel, which the first viewing, I thought it was Alma, but then they would have given her, anytime she's there, they make sure to give her a couple of lines and some screen time. But I felt like whoever this was just kind of pushed out, especially when they're walking.
It almost seemed like they were purposely trying to hide this person, you know, throughout the whole scene. You never really got a good look at her face. And I felt so bad for her because she wasn't part of the conversation. And
yeah. It does seem kind of odd, though. I didn't really think about it the first couple of times. But then we were watching it this last time right before we came to podcast. I was just like, yeah, what's up with that?
So they're talking about Eden and Isaac because they've actually gone to the wall and they're hanging on the wall. And Janine wants to believe that they are in heaven together, which Emily feels that, you know, it would be better if they were alive here together.
Yeah.
And Janine gets upset, feels like that Emily only ever sees the bad, and she's not always complaining herself. In front of Eden and Isaac's bodies are two Marthas who are there observing. And, you know, when you watch it again and you know that there's this whole Martha network and all that stuff, it kind of makes you wonder what their conversation is. You know, if they're discussing already what's going to happen later on.
That's a good point. I didn't think of that. I just thought they were just kind of like set dressing there, you know, like, go, okay, there's some people down here observing the people who've hung up on the wall.
And there's been so many people who have hung on that wall, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people who were hung because they were gay, because they had an affair, or, you know, just stuff like that, that is not a reason to hang somebody.
Somebody who had, well, I guess it would be a reason to them, the guy who helped June, Omar.
Right. Yeah, Omar. Yeah. So you would think that, you know, any one of those could have been a catalyst.
Yeah.
And you have to go, well, why Eden? Why now? Because she lived to the letter of law in Gilead and still paid a price, a fatal price. I mean, it almost seems unfair that it would take that, but because there's already been just so much tragedy and abhorrent killings and stuff like that. But I'm trying to get to the, like, understanding why Eden would be the catalyst above other people.
Well, going with the idea that you're going with, just to take a look, you know, it does suck to think that all of these other people have died. And, you know, now it's this person, this 15-year-old girl, and then all of a sudden it's going to cause this revolution or something like that. But maybe if you look at it from the point of view that everybody had gotten, maybe they've just gotten so used to the death that they, and seeing people hang on the wall, that they understand this just to be a fact of life. But now that there's somebody who was part of Gilead's structure, somebody who played by the rules, somebody who was doing what they should have and then just stepped out of line this one time, and they went ahead and killed them.
I think that's it. And the fact that you mentioned she's 15 years old, that has to maybe have a little bit more impact.
I would imagine it would. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, a 15-year-old girl, you just, you know, if this was a normal, sane society, that this person can't even, they're not even to the age of majority yet. They can't even give consent to sexual activity. It would be illegal. So the fact that this person is supposed to be married and having babies at this point mm-hmm. is just asinine anyway. And then they're going to go and kill her because she had a teenage crush with somebody and ran away with them. You know, there was no other less severe punishment that they could have done. And it's just, it starts to probably affect people. And they're even, you know, even people who might have been slightly bought into, you know, the like a whole Stockholm syndrome thing at this point, however many years in, some of these people probably started going, oh, crap. Well, if they can do that to her, you know, .. The sky's the limit. You know, I would be less worthy, way less worthy of consideration is probably what's going through a lot of people's heads. So I guess that's the best reason I could think of.
So at this point, June tells the handmaids about Eden's hidden Bible, and they all agree that she was brave. Emily announces it will be the first ceremony with Commander Lawrence, which, you know, I guess like Janine is really the only one who hasn't really kind of come to this conclusion that everybody else has. But Janine is still just being Janine because she's getting on Emily's case for seeing only negative. And then when Emily announces that it's her ceremony, she's like, oh, the first ones are the worst or so awkward. Like she's still bought into this shit, or at least like found her groove.
Well, a few episodes back, I'm not sure how many episodes back, I had made, like, I miscalled her situation and said that she was the most adjusted to life in Gilead. And you said, I don't think she's adjusted to it. I think she's just kind of a little bit twisted in the head, maybe. You know, those weren't your words, but it was kind of the sentiment. Like, she's been knocked around enough by life to just kind of have found, like, okay, well, this is... adjusted is the wrong word, but like accepting of circumstances and then basing that as your new reality. Like,
this is how she survives.
Yeah. So I think you were right then and you're right now. This the reason it's still right, I guess I should say, is this is the impetus for her behavior. It's survival mechanism. You know, she's trying to deal the best with the card she's been dealt.
We also learned that Emily's son's, his name is Oliver, his birthday is next week, so we may open season 3 with her arriving on his birthday, being reunited with him on his birthday.
That would be a little bit of a nice perk for not seeing June get on the van at the end of it. I don't know if anything's really going to make up for that, anything that I can think of off the top of my head, but it would be kind of cool.
The next scene I've titled The Meeting of the Wives. I'm not sure what event has brought them together. Maybe this is something that happens on the regular.
Were there more babies than just Angela and, I don't even know whether to call her Nicole or Holly now, but Holly/Nicole, were there more babies than that?
I only recall seeing them, and I thought it was weird because they were almost like the same size.
Yeah, which, you know, apparently Angela has gained another 6 ounces, which we've since learned is pretty paltry anyway, so.
Yeah, I think she said 9 ounces, which... I think last time Commander Putnam had said 4 ounces or 6 ounces or something like that. And I had a conversation with Sarah Powers, also known as Dr. D's. She's a parent, and so she knows a bit about gaining weight, and it's not really all that much. And in fact, you know, as far as what babies should be gaining on a daily basis, should actually maybe even be a little bit more than that. So I don't know if this is like a day-to-day conversation and... And she's gained 9 ounces as of yesterday. And they've had this conversation on a regular basis where Serena's constantly checking in about the baby's weight.
Apparently, it's a big thing because Naomi calls her little rock star, which I thought was out of place to say that, because that's indicative of like the old world. There's no rock stars in Gilead. There's no music. There's no band. Well, unless you're you've got some contraband records or whatever, if you're a commander. But like I felt like it was put in there, and I didn't even notice it till the second or third watch, but I felt like it was put in there to make us more amenable to the fact that she agreed to have this meeting at Serena's request so quickly.
Yeah, it felt really expedited.
Yeah.
And I mean, even the conversation as Serena and Naomi are walking down the stairs wasn't totally, it's like as you described, it was innuendos. And so I wasn't even sure if Naomi Putnam was truly on board or if she was just toying with Serena just to like trap Serena or, it just takes me by surprise that Naomi would be even involved in such a manner.
Yeah, there's been no hint before now that anybody but Serena feels anything but just totally happy with the way things are going on. I mean, I'm sure it chafes in one way or another at all of the wives, but they all have complicity, right? They all have some manner of culpability to Gilead. So it's kind of like you don't really think about it too much, or at least I don't, because you're going, well, you helped construct this, or you are the supportive wife of somebody who helped construct this, so you made your bed, lie in it type thing. But apparently there's some resentments, maybe some petty, some larger, that seethe under the surface with a lot of these women. Enough to where they felt enough solidarity to be able to back Serena, you know, up until the point that she cracked a book. But, you know.
It would have been nice to have more scenes with the wives and kind of like getting to know their thoughts on everything. And maybe even like the ones that were supportive of Gilead and seeing some of the tension between some of the wives and maybe even some of the changes and even the things that might cause people to change, like Naomi herself, to get to this point, you know, have it like as a parallel story along with these handmaids that we're constantly witnessing chattering to each other behind their bonnets.
I know exactly what you mean. I would have loved to have seen that. That would have given it the that I overuse this phrase, but it's apt, you know, the connective tissue between like Serena just being able to have this offhand conversation with Naomi that's really full of innuendos, and then all of a sudden they're ready to follow her into war up to a point. But it's having those parallel scenes would have gone a long way, even one or two of them sprinkled here and there. But all you really ever got was these women being together for these crazy, stupid rituals, and then like kind of, you know, backstabbing acrimony that showed you that, you know, these are just the people who she has to deal with, that who are her equals in society, so she has to fill time with, but she doesn't really like them, as evidenced by her walk when June was still pregnant and she just talked shit about different wives the whole time.
Yeah.
That, yeah,
specifically
with Serena.
Naomi, yeah.
So I don't know. The scene kind of, like, the word you used is probably the most apt for it, is expedited. Because we needed it to be to this point, so here we go. This is what you get,
right,
to get us there. And
I mean, like, even they could have shown Naomi react to Eden's execution and some other commanders' wives that we've seen their faces from time to time and just kind of got an idea what their temperature is at this point.
Maybe even instead of having the Marthas stand in front of the two, you know, people on the wall, they could have had a couple of wives walking by and kind of pause and look up to it meaningfully, mm-hmm, somehow. And then it just gives you just that little bit, goes such a long way. But when something feels forced like that, it's that like late inning. I mean, we're either at or past the halfway point in the episode at this point, and then it's the season finale, and this just comes out right now.
Meanwhile, Emily prepares for the ceremony. So she's woken by the house clock, or she's alerted by the house clock that it's time for the ceremony. So she makes her way downstairs while Ichiku Park plays in the background, which is by a band called Small Faces. It seemed like Commander Lawrence was playing that music in the house, but I didn't actually see him turn it off or anything like that. So I'm not sure if it was just soundtrack music or if he was actually playing that.
I got the impression that he was playing that. That's, I don't know for sure either, because I mean, they do that sometimes. They just play music over a scene, but those scenes usually tend to be a little more expansive or montage-y, mm-hmm, than this one. This was like pretty focused, and it was in the middle of an episode, so I felt like he had a record on.
So she walks down the stairs and she peeks into the living room area and she sees the pillow that she's supposed to kneel on. So that confirms to her that yes, this event's going to happen. And so she runs into the kitchen, grabs a knife, and she slips it into her belt or whatever, and she kneels down and waits. And then Commander Lawrence walks in the room and he yells for Cora, who's not at home. So Cora is probably at a Martha meeting planning their main event for the night.
She's she could, I mean, I could see her being towards the top of the Martha hierarchy because of the leeway that she's afforded.
Uh-huh.
She could actually make plans and not have to do, she wouldn't have to be so furtive, because I mean, outside of the house anyway, because remember, in this house they value privacy.
Yeah, and he's probably involved, you know, so he's probably helped facilitated. It'll be interesting to find out, because Bradley Whitford has signed on for season 3. He will be back. I did read an interview with Bruce Miller. We're going to learn a lot more about Commander Lawrence next season.
Good. I want to, because he's an enigmatic character. I want to learn like I want to, you know, get into the emotional and intellectual guts of how he could have been so involved in all of this bad stuff, but then turn out to do the right thing. Like, what changed him?
Yeah.
What was his moment?
I liked how he wondered out loud how can you motivate employees if you can't leverage salaries?
Yeah.
So that was a clue right there. If you were still wondering about him, like, he views Cora as an employee.
Yeah. You know, and before he had even said that, I felt like that was more of the relationship that they had had. Even if you take away these innuendos that they could be lovers, which a few people that we've talked to and wrote into us have thought, and we had thought that too as well. But even if you delete that from the equation, you still feel like the relationship is more akin to a boss and an employee. So it is pretty apt that he's saying that, because you can't give him any further compensation. There's nothing to do, because it's like, hey, raises make people work harder. Duh. But what, like, I mean, what is your, that you've got no tools at your disposal to get people to, like, hey, I'll kill you less sooner. I don't know. I mean, what works in that?
And he also just wonders about Cora casually, like, oh, maybe she's out and about, where, you know, so he's not micromanaging her time.
Yeah.
Constantly surveilling her.
And I imagine that differs from house to house anyway. You know, if you have like some really controlling or perverted commander who's just wanting to be nasty like that, you know, he could be that way. But, you know, I feel like Fred doesn't really have tabs on what, you know, I mean, Rita's running that household. So it's like she does what she needs to do. I mean, this jackass doesn't even know where the tea is. So I think they all have a certain amount of leeway, but Cora really has some, you know. She's, you know, like, oh, she left and went and did something. That's fine. I mean, she was driving later on in the episode, so
I wouldn't say Rita runs that house at all. She just does everything, and that's the reason why he can't find the tea.
She's making it all happen, even though she has to do it herself.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a one person job, and she's doing it all, but
she keeps the household running.
Yeah, maybe that's the best way to put it.
So he realizes that Emily's sitting there waiting, and he wants to know what she's doing. And she tells him that it's the night of the ceremony. And he says, no, get up. I'm not going to do that with you.
Did you expect him to say something along those lines? Like, this isn't going to happen, or?
Yeah, you know? I started to have that feeling just because it didn't really feel like he was even thinking about it. It just, I don't know, even when she looked the door and she saw the pillow there, I just didn't think that it was going to go that way. I didn't know what was going to happen necessarily.
Right.
But I didn't think he was going to be into doing the ceremony.
And if anybody had watched the preview for this episode, it was entirely misleading as to what was going to happen in this household over this particular couple of days. Total misdirection. But I mean, this guy's more worried about the whereabouts of Cora and orange juice. So he gives zero fucks about a ceremony.
So now we have Serena before the men of Gilead. And it's so insulting when that other commander, I think it was a Commander Grinnell.
I believe so.
Says, did you forget your lunch today, Waterford?
It's just so much of a boys' club. And this is where I keep harping on that whole thing about the insecurities of a certain kind of man who needs to be in control. And this is what it amounts to. You know, women are not even seen as, it's not even a, like, getting to the point where they could be seen as equal would be bringing them up in these guys' estimation several levels. Because at this point, they're just, I mean, they're, what are they, like, Marthas who don't, in this society, what are they, Marthas who don't have to work and do anything? They just wear different, slightly different colored clothes and walk around in high heels and do these goofy ceremonies and shit like that. They have no agency. They have no real purpose. Even when the handmaids have the children, the Marthas bring them up. They do everything.
Yeah, they're trophy wives.
So it's, and then to that, if that's not bad enough, then they have to, you know, be degraded even further. Like, oh, she was bringing you your bag lunch because you forgot it at the house. What a doting wife.
Yeah, and when Commander Grinnell said, did you forget your lunch today, Waterford, and all the other men are dicks. So Serena has come before them because she's would like to propose an amendment. And then she mentioned we would like to propose an amendment. And Commander Waterford's like, we? Which is his way of going, not me. I ain't a part of this. Who are you talking about, girl?
Don't include me in your we. Because I don't know what you're talking about.
Like, let's make it clear in front of my boys that I am not part of the we.
Yeah.
And when Serena makes her proposal. Commander Putnam describes it as a radical proposal. And that's all we hear from him. But later on, she mentions him being open to it. So I'm not quite sure if there's a deleted scene or if she just interpreted that as a positive response.
All I can think of is he's grasping, or she's grasping at straws, and he's the only person who opened his mouth and said anything, because he was trying to be polite, I think. Like, okay, well, sure, we'll look into this or something. You know, like, just the really, I'm going to pretty much just put this in file 13, but, you know, I'm going to pretend. So,
well, Commander Waterford is the one who, you know, tries to put the cap on it by saying, we'll look into this later. And he glowers as he says it. And then Serena pulls out the Bible, Eden's Bible, and begins to read, reading about the Word of God. And this is when some of the wives behind her start to kind of exfoliate from the group, start to peel away, not wanting to be associated with this law breaking.
So I'm left wondering what she thought she was going to get out of doing that. Like showing up in force with all of the other wives and kind of throwing down the gauntlet and saying, hey, listen to our demands, listen to what we're trying to say, etc. And then that's one thing. But then she did a little bit of a bait and switch, because she didn't tell anybody she was going to pull out a book, much less the Bible, and start reading it in front of all of the commanders in the district. So I'm kind of wondering if she thought everybody was going to hang around, or if she knew that some of them would peel away and she'd hopefully keep a faithful core who would stand by her and be like, right on, we got your back.
I think she probably thought after everything, because there's been a lot of disagreement, especially between her and Commander Waterford, that has led to clashing between the two of them. But I think she thought if she could get to what was, you know, to use your phrase, connective tissue, the main impetus behind everything they've done, if she could get to the source and use that as a way to support her cause, that surely it would speak to them. And she was wrong.
You'd think she'd be right, because it's like, okay, she's not advocating for everybody. You know, it's not as if she was saying, let's go into the Econo people's houses and give them a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas. She's just basically saying, I think our daughters should be able to at least read the Bible so they can follow the Word of God. You know, the whole reason why this society exists in the first place, right? And we're not in America right now. So it wasn't in like a crazy thing, but to them, they're just like, no, you know, we'll bend rules however we see fit for our own purposes, but not for this, not for you.
So now outside, waiting in the hallways, some of the wives are still there in support of Serena. Naomi's still there, and she tells Serena, you shouldn't have done that. And at this point, Serena quotes Goethe talking about bold actions. And Naomi knew it was Goethe, but then she also described him as a German heretic, and then Serena corrects her on that. Huh. But that is interesting to me, because that might be some backstory into their friendship, is something that they both have an interest and are able to have like discussions about things. Maybe even intellectual discussions have happened between the two of them.
They could have been English majors together or something, or literature majors, or you know, went to the same school, and I don't know.
Yeah, but it would have been nice to actually see.
Oh yeah,
that relationship.
You know, and that would have been a great way for the show, because the flashbacks that you get of people from Gilead have been mostly confined to season one. And it's pretty unsympathetic stuff. It's some of these commanders maneuvering to get into positions, and you have like people shooting up places and all kinds of violence and nasty shit. And then the only even semi-sympathetic flashbacks you get are of Fred and Serena. But even then, they really just serve to underscore certain elements of their relationship dynamic, rather than give you the feelies like you do when you get flashbacks with all the good guys. Mm-hmm. So if we could have been just even a little bit more emotionally invested in either of these characters, if we had gotten some like good times flashbacks with them, and to where we could maybe not agree, obviously, with their intentions towards Gilead, but we could see them as people who were trying to do what they felt was right. And I think they tried to sprinkle a little bit of that in there, but if they had done a little bit more, then situations like this would have even more of an emotional impact when they happen.
They would have. So Commander Waterford walks out and thanks the commander's wives, basically placing emphasis on thank you, goodbye, in his behind his words. And so they take the hint and they leave, and Serena's left alone with Commander Waterford. And she tells him that she was trying to set an example for their daughter, and he says, so you have. And that's when these commanders come and take Serena away, and she's screaming for Fred.
it's interesting to see what Fred will commit to and what atrocities he'll do, what nastiness he'll be involved in, how he'll get his hands dirty with stuff. Well, he didn't do this, so he's not even getting his hands dirty, but he's not stopping it. So what he'll let happen in the name of following Gilead's, you know, letter of the law type of thing, and then what he'll let himself get away with for his own selfish pleasure, whether it's fun time with the handmaid or whether it's going to Jezebel's, whether it's bending the rules to keep her in the house, you know, and any number of other little things here and there. So just the, you compare the two, and he's willing to let his wife lose a finger for a transgression, but he's willing to allow himself to do all of this other stuff. I mean, that's not just a slippery slope. That's a sheer wall of ice, you know, that the White Walkers are going to try to get over, because that's what that is.
Well, before we find out what Serena's fate is at the hands of these guardians that took her away, which I thought it was going to be worse than a finger cut off, which I don't know why I thought that, because I already knew what the punishment was.
Yeah.
But I did wonder if they would go, you know, medieval on her, because we had Commander Lawrence mention a hand cut off, like if they would like inflict an even harsher punishment than what they've reduced it to, because it's Serena.
So they would try to make an example, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I just thought it was going to be, I mean, it's bad enough, but I just thought it was going to be worse. I even thought maybe they might kill her. I was a little worried. But before we find that out, we have Aunt Lydia paying a visit to Emily to see how the first ceremony went. And before we talk about the the part that made me cheer, and I did cheer, which kind of surprised me, but I don't know why it surprised me, but it did. But before we get to that, I was disappointed that Aunt Lydia was back to being just this automaton fucking Gilead soldier, because the last time we saw her, she seemed worried about placing Emily in this household. So somehow, you know, she got it right in her head that it must be okay. I'm going to go and check to make sure that Emily behaved during, and that the ceremony happened, and that she's going to appreciate her new circumstances.
I see exactly what you're saying, but I took it to be that she had stepped out of the automaton role in her concern for Emily when she dropped her off. She was wondering if this was the right thing, et cetera, et cetera. We've already talked about it, but like, I felt like when she came back, it kind of fit. Because once she had talked to Lawrence and Lawrence had eased her concerns, like, oh, she's fine. He probably blew a bunch of smoke up her ass to keep her quiet and said, yeah, Emily's fine. She's doing what she's supposed to do. We had our first ceremony last night and everything went great. And so Aunt Lydia's like, oh, okay, I didn't fuck up by bringing her here. And now, you know, people have I think it's human nature to have a tendency to do that. When you're unsure about something, you're a little bit more open to other ideas possibly about ways of behavior. But when you feel safe, when you feel vindicated or validated in your beliefs, then you can go back into your old ways, and because they're justified somehow. And then she just comes in and starts being the Aunt Lydia that we hate. Of course, once we see what happens after that, we see why she was they had to prime us for that, you know.
Yeah, speaking of primed, I think Emily was primed to kill, and she wasn't able to do that. She just needs to attack her oppressors, and so that thing was still within her. And then you have Aunt Lydia come in and just sit there talking about how she needs to just appreciate, blah, 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 behave, follow the rules, know your position, da-da-da-da-da. And when Emily's not responding in the way that she would like, she says, it's like I cut out your tongue. It's like, no, bitch, you cut out my fucking clit, knife in your back, throw you over the staircase. Hopefully you broke your neck when you hit that fucking railing. I'm going to kick you all the way down the stairs now.
It was fun to watch in that same brutal way that it was fun to watch Uma Thurman and Kill Bill. You have this just like, this was a lot more realistic violence than anything that Tarantino's doing, obviously. But it still evokes that same feeling that I would get while watching it, where you're cheering for the violence, and you know there's a small part of you that's going, should you be doing this? But it feels so right, because this person has perpetrated so many wrongs. So it feels like justice is what it feels like.
Yeah, I had that exact feeling, because right when she stabbed her in the back and threw her over, I actually had like this weird laughter come out of my mouth, and I was shocked by my expression towards that. And a little concern towards myself.
Well,
but That, I mean, and that's one of the things about the show that you can say that they're successful with is getting you to feel what these characters are feeling. And I think that's why people get so emotional and upset, especially with how it ended.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain times where violence is portrayed very accurately in this show. And this is one of those times where it's just this gawky, awkward, very like unexpected kind of thing where you can't predict where it's going to go. So when she goes over that railing and then she hits her head on it, she could have easily broke her neck when she hits the railing coming down because she's got a little bit of weight to her, you know, and gravity's working and she got pushed over as well. So she's got that momentum and man, that just looked like, you know, but that part of you that you're talking about that is, you know, you're a little bit like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be stoking this fire of wanting violence and everything. I was kind of hoping that Emily would kick her in the face a few times, but that didn't happen.
Or kick her in the like knife handle and push it in further. If she survives, she'll be disabled for sure. And it'll be interesting to see how Gilead treats their disabled people because we haven't seen any. We've talked about this.
We know at the beginning of the episode when June is going over all of the names. Not names, but all of the positions that women can have in Gilead, mm-hmm. and she, or just maybe in society in general, and she goes through all of them. And Aunt is not on that list, but because I was thinking at the time when she was reading them off, because I was going to relate it to this scene and say like, well, where would she fit in if she wasn't able to do that? Because there's no like elderly people here. You don't see, and we even talked about this. You don't even see pets anywhere.
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah.
So. There's a lot of deletions from normal society that aren't quite explained. So I'm hoping that in season three we get
all
a
the
little
things
bit.
That make life warm is just completely sucked out of it.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. I have a feeling though that Aunt Lydia is dead because of the timeline of this, and you know that's what I'm thinking. Unless Commander Lawrence has a lot more tricks up his sleeve and has a lot more pull than we're supposing right now.
But Cora. Comes in and she discovers what just happened. She yells for the commander to call an ambulance and locks Emily in a room, tells her to stay there. And Emily goes through a series of emotions. At first, she's laughing, and then the weight of what she just did comes over her because she doesn't know what her fate's going to be. It's not her first kill, but I think she believes at this point, though, that this could be her last moments.
I agree.
As a result, where, you know, she was able to get away with the other two. And I think she knew she could at that time.
It's almost like the euphoria wears off. And then she's like, oh, fuck, I didn't just, you know, kill a guardian. I killed this.
Aunt Lydia.
Yeah. The head honcho. So that's pretty bad.
So now back at the Waterfords, June opens the door for Serena and Commander Waterford to enter the house. Commander Waterford escorts Serena to her room and hands a bag to June to bring upstairs. And we don't know what's in that bag. We're wondering if it was Eden's Bible, if it was Serena's finger.
Why would he keep the finger, though?
I don't know. Maybe it's both. They flatten the finger into a bookmark, and it's now in the book. It'd serve as a warning. Like, if you open this again, remember the finger!
Oh, that would be some macabre humor, wouldn't it? A flattened finger bookmark inside of a Bible you can't open.
Instead of pressed flowers, it's pressed fingers. So June follows them upstairs and she sees how tenderly, and that's not really a good word for that dickhead, but he's helping Serena into her room. And June says, Mrs. Waterford, in a questioning way. And Commander Waterford says, we had a difficult day. He leaves to go get Serena some tea. And this gives June an opportunity to see what happened. Serena unwraps her hand to reveal her maimed pinky. Serena says, I tried. June has no words for this, so she sits down and just puts her hand on Serena's unmaimed hand there. And then later on, she goes downstairs to confront Commander Waterford in the kitchen. And Rita's missing. And so we just had a scene where Commander Lawrence was trying to find Cora. Well, now we have Commander Waterford trying to find Rita, and she's at some unknown location because even June doesn't know where she's at. But June gets to the point why she's there in the kitchen, and she says, you let them do that to Serena. And he says, we all have our roles to play. Serena needs to be reminded of hers.
So I wonder if there's a little bit of foreshadowing in this for what's going to happen with Fred's eventual demise, because if we all have roles to play, he has his too, and he's been doing nothing but failing and stepping outside of what those roles are.
You know, it's interesting because you were talking about earlier when Serena made her proposal in front of the commanders it's like, what is their function as commander's wives? It's really hard to say. Like, they're given babies to assuage them, but there's really no role or function for them. And, you know, and if you tie it to also the stream of titles or words that June was thinking of as far as what applies to a woman in Gilead, wife was being one of them. And all they are is just words. They're not, it's not people. And I think that also ties in with the title of this episode, The Word. It's like they're more than just those words, a wife, a handmaid, a daughter. And that, and they these commanders decide to not look at the truth of that, just like they don't want the truth known, you know, by educating their daughters.
So it's kind of this emptiness, this hollow thing
that they keep trying to force them in into their hollow roles.
So it's kind of coming home to roost in a way. Because you've given them, like you're saying, you've given them the title, but there's no agency to be had. There's no actual role to be fulfilled. It's just an empty thing. And then you say, okay, well then why, how do you, I mean, one of the things that everybody says, whether you're religious or not, that comes from, I don't even know if it comes from the Bible, but people say it all the time, idle hands are the devil's workshop. So, you know, these women are nothing if not idle. Yeah, they have their ceremonies that they go to, and they have their knitting and their gardening and things like this. But these are hobbies. You know, people who work full-time jobs have hobbies. That's what we're doing right now. You know, but it's like, so that's not going to keep you from, you know, if you don't have a real like goal or function or purpose in life, if you don't have anything you can strive towards, I mean, it's a basic ingredient of fulfilled humanity in a modern society is to have something like that. And you've given them none of it.
Well, I imagine Serena probably thought she had a purpose up until now, which would be to raise her daughter and teach her the word of God. But then she just now realized that that purpose is taken from her. Like, she can't actually really teach the word of God to her child if that child cannot actually seek the truth in a book. So that there is no purpose anymore. It that might have been the only shred of purpose she had left, and that's turns out to be non-existent. She has no control over that.
And it works well for the I agree with what you're saying completely, and it works well for the dramatics of this particular episode and as an impetus to get her to where she is in an emotional state towards the end of the episode where she lets June and Holly/Nicole go. But it seems almost inconceivable that she hadn't thought about this before. Like, why now? You know, and maybe just everything that happened with Eden just kind of like cracked that open in her head.
I wondered, okay, this next part of this scene starts with Fred kind of like just pushing the tea tray on the counter towards June, and he starts talking about obedience of a handmaid. And I thought he was going to say, like, you take this tea up to Serena, but that's not why he starts talking about obedience of a handmaid. Because then he starts to kind of walk his way around to come around behind her so he could eventually grab that tray and then take it up. So he was pushing it across so he could actually grab it with ease on the other side. But it's an interesting way to block this scene because he actually kind of tries to ensnare her in this circle while at the same time trying to ply her and mesmerize her with promises of, oh, if you behave, like, I might be able to keep you in this house and you can stay here with your daughter. And then even when she tells him, you can go fuck yourself, Fred, you know, he finishes with saying, I might even be able to arrange more meetings with Hannah.
It's almost like he's the serpent in the garden, just around the back of her, whispering in her ear all of these promises. If you just bite the apple, you know, and agree to this, like, he can force her to do it. But if he wants her acquiescence, you know, he wants her to go, yes, this is what I want. I want to be around you, Fred. He wants that validation of the reciprocation of feelings between them. And it kind of, just until now, I hadn't thought of it, but the way you were describing it, and then I was picturing it in my head. He's like the depictions of the serpent, kind of, you know, he's coming down from the tree, whispering in her ear, like, this is how things could be if you just do this, even though you're not supposed to, and we can bend the rules and et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's pretty bold of her to tell him to fuck off, to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
You know, but I feel like this particular scene is where the show gets really political in a not in a tightly focused way that has to do with Gilead itself, but in a bigger, I don't even know if I want to say meta way, because I never know if I'm really using that word completely correctly, but just in a bigger picture sense. And he talks about wanting an obedient woman. And what this all boils down to is it's a reactionary mindset that is against anything that is progressive at all. So it's male domination of a society, and females and people who are non-heterosexual, we'll say, everybody who falls outside of that, are subjugated, and this is the way to reassert, you know what I mean? To have the males who know what to do and can be the arbiters of everything need to be back into control. They felt control slipping away from them over the years. I think Fred cares way less about babies than he does about this. I think his focus is to be back in the driver's seat as a man by having all of the people in his orbit, females and everybody, even males under him, have to be paying him some sort of servitude. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is really about. And it's trying to roll back all of the progressivism that happened in the last, I don't know how many decades in America. And that's what Gilead really represents at its apex. So I think all of this shit about wanting the birth rates to go back up and everybody being a good Bible student and all this other stuff, it's phony baloney. It's a smokescreen. Really what it's about is just like, you know, I don't know if it was Orwell. I don't want to quote out of, you know, like be inaccurately, but it's a picture of boot on a human neck for all eternity. And that's what Gilead is, pure and simple. It's these males controlling.
Yeah. And that's why I'm looking forward to getting to know Commander Lawrence, because I want to know what he thought it was when they first started out. And if he was originally in agreement, or if there was just different ideas behind what they were going to do, and there was some divisions, and some of the more toxic men just ended up becoming exalted within this hierarchy. I'm glad we're going to get to know Commander Lawrence, because I think that's going to give us a window into how all this came together by getting to know him. Because he's going to be somebody we're going to want to get to know, you know. And I think the show is going to use him in that way, to where we can, I bet we'll get flashbacks with him.
I would love that. I would love flashbacks. I want more flashbacks about the construction of Gilead. I want, you know, because when you were talking about the more toxic men, one of the things that I've always read, and it's been a long time since I read it, but like you're thinking about Soviet Russia, and you had Lenin was on his deathbed, but he couldn't speak because of whatever condition he was under. He had fallen ill, and he didn't want Stalin to be in control like he was. He didn't want him to take the mantle of power, but he couldn't really tell anybody this. And long story short, the wrong people who were not intended by the originators of that society to get into power got into power ultimately and did a bunch of stuff. So if there's like some sort of similar trajectory there, not going by the numbers with that exact scenario, but just however, like you were saying, the more toxic guys were able to take over for some reason, even though a light or a diet version of Gilead would still be pretty shitty. But still, you know, there could have, I think that's a completely feasible thing, and I would really like them to explore that if that's the case.
But as far as June telling Fred to go fuck himself, that was awesome, because you had already that being said to him. Prior to that, you had Emily stabbing Aunt Lydia in the back, and prior to that, you had June smacking Fred back. So it was this really effective use of mechanics that were creating this sense of a fever pitch, and the effect it had on me, and I know you, as we were watching it, was really, really intense.
Especially when we got up to this point, I mean, I could feel like spikes of anxiety going through, because this is the final season, or this is the final episode of this season. Something big's going to happen. Am I going to like it? Am I going to hate it? Where's it going? And you're right, it just kept a building block. And so this is one of the elements that made this episode so great up to that 98% point. So, you know, it just kept barreling towards that.
So the next scene, we have Commander Lawrence escorting Emily out of the house. And it's nighttime by this point. So, I mean, it seemed like morning. It was definitely daytime when Aunt Lydia was there. Or it could have been late afternoon. I don't know. There's got to be at least a few hours that have passed since Aunt Lydia was stabbed in the back. I don't want to say killed, because I don't know for sure.
But this change from day to night is why I think she's dead.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't see her dead.
Yeah, that's true.
And what I liked right off the bat was that Cora was driving. So I already knew this is not to worry.
Right.
Even though he's acting strange because he says, "You must feel so proud of yourself," to Emily. And then he wants to put on some music and he plays in what happens to be on the radio or in his CD player or what, I don't know, was Annie Lennox, Walking on Broken Glass. I can't remember what. Cora was the one that turned it on, right?
I don't remember.
It doesn't matter.
One. Yeah.
And that would be unnerving. If you're like in this emotional state, you don't know where you're being taken. And you just murdered Aunt, or maybe you just murdered Aunt Lydia, and you're sitting in the back seat and you've got somebody just blithely, you know, enjoying a really upbeat song at high volume. I don't blame her for asking him to turn it off.
It'd be like a meat grinder for your nerves. You'd just be like, oh, so she played that scene really well. Alexis Bledel, the way you could, you know, that nobody's doing shitty acting in this show. Let's get that out there, you know. But this was just really well done. She like showed anxiety in a very demonstrable way. Like you could see if you had no sound on your TV and you were watching that, you'd be like, that person's not happy at all in this situation.
And I think, you know, the scene was played this way because they're still trying to make you wonder what this guy is all about. What's his agenda? What's he going to do with Emily? Can we trust him? But I also wondered if it was a way for Bruce Miller to put in some commentary about people not liking the music that was in season one. You know, some of the, you got handmaids walking in army formation, you got Nina Simone playing in the background. There was people who didn't like that. And so when she asks him to turn it off and he's like, oh, so it is, you don't like music then.
Well, there could be some truth to that because they don't seem to be above a little bit of, here's the word again, the meta kind of things, right? Because whenever Aunt Lydia was having the conversation previously, like way back in the season, with Serena talking about, she goes, I used to smoke, dear, but I stopped because you have to quit and blah, blah, blah. And people kind of said that might be like a tongue-in-cheek nod to Ann Dowd's character of Patty in the HBO series The Leftovers, which we hadn't started watching yet at the time. But if we did, it would have been super funny because one of us would have caught it and started laughing. So if both of those can be seen to be doing kind of that on the level, I think showrunners do that kind of stuff personally.
Well, it may turn out that Emily may be haunted by Ann Dowd in Canada and she might have to go to the hotel and drown her in a well.
Which she'll have no problem doing. There won't be any of that, you know, will she, won't she.
So now we're back with June and she's feeding and burping Holly. Sirens alert her to look out the window. Fire has broken out across the street. And originally I was thinking maybe it was Commander Lawrence's house and that was the way he was dealing with Aunt Lydia's body. But then I was like, wait, his wife's there. Why would he do that?
Yeah.
Rita tells June she and the baby have an opportunity to leave now. And June takes her fucking time. It's like, get the fuck out, June. Here's your opportunity. What are you doing? And the rest of the episode is June pretty much taking her time, getting the fuck out.
You know, when
end of recap. Just kidding. Yeah.
When you watch the episode the first time, it's played to your nerves at this point are strung like a fiddle. You know, you're just so taut, and the writers are just playing you, right? And so the second time or the third time you watch it, you start to go, wow, some of this is just like implausible. She would have been running for her life if this was reality. But she stops to do several different things, not the least of which is to write the Carborundorum quote on the wall.
Novitae te bastardus Carborundorum.
Right. Like, how long did that take? How long did it take you to just say it? I mean, and she's up there like, I don't know what she used.
Yeah, what implement did she use?
She doesn't have access to a set of markers, that's for sure.
It looks like she carved it.
That would take fucking minutes.
I know.
Minutes.
It's ridiculous. I hated it. I mean, I like, obviously, the phrase, but the fact that she took the time to do that.
It looks really cool on the wall, but it's just so fucking practical that it's almost laughable to where you're just like, you had no writing implement. You had to scrape it. With what? What were you using? You know, I just don't know. But I guess, you know, when you're, I guess what's happening is the writers are thinking that, okay, well, or Bruce Miller is thinking you're going to be caught up in the emotion of this. And that's going to be a good gut punch whenever Fred comes up and sees that. And you're going to be like, yeah, take that fucker. But the logistics, the reality logistics of it are all wrong.
So as June rounds, as she comes down the steps and she passes the front door, she sees Nick out there, and he nods at her, which is telling her that he's part of this, and it's like their little goodbye that they have. She now has to navigate herself through the yard and to get past the greenhouse, which we do see Serena in there. Serena's looking out the window trying to figure out what the hell's going on. Commander Waterford is at first unaware of what's going on, and we actually see him at his desk, and we get to see a map that looks different than the map that was in the McKenzie household. And I did read about this, how, yes, Gilead has taken control of United States mainland, the contiguous states, but that the different color variations actually indicate how much control they actually have in these areas. So they don't have complete control everywhere. There's uprisings and maybe not enough forces working on their behalf and stuff like that. They're probably spread thin in some areas. So they still have a lot of work to do as far as like keeping the population under their control, looks like. So I think showing that map is a promise to us viewers that we're actually going to see more geographically. We've seen a few maps this season. We've had even June mention to Nick that even as far away as California is Gilead. So I feel like those are little nuggets that are placed in there to let us know that we are going to see more.
I hope so. I hope you're right about that. I believe that you're right. I concur with all of the points you just made. I'm just hoping that that is really the case.
Yeah. So after he hears the sirens himself, he looks out the window and he walks out and encounters Rita, and he asks her what's going on. And she says she doesn't know. So he starts to go out the front door, and then he turns again and looks at Rita, and the look on her face cues him instead to go check on the baby, and the baby is not there. So then he runs to June's room and he finds Nolita Tepesarda's Carbo and Darum carved on her wall. He starts yelling for Nick and commands him to organize for a search party. And that's when Nick puts his hand on his shoulder and tells Commander Waterford, it's too dangerous out there. We'll stay here. And he has to put his hand on his gun, making his real point to the commander.
So here we have two people who are going to be part of a shitstorm once this all settles, because really, I mean, you know, Rita just gave away her part in it with that look. And then Nick's obviously giving away his part in it with what he's doing. So, I mean, I'm more afraid for those two than I am for June at the beginning of season three.
Well, with Commander Waterford being a propaganda minister, he's on point for the media now.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact terminology they said last episode. He's very much aware of how that would make him look if his whole household rose up against him. So I have a feeling he's going to spin it in a way to where he's going to keep them there, punish them in his own way, but he's not going to allow the idea that he had no control over his own household. People are like, well, if you can't control your own household, why should we give you a leadership position here?
Yeah, I agree with that. It almost seems like he would have to. Like, he doesn't have any other choice. He would have to do something like that. And so, because how many strikes are they going to give Waterford before they put him on the wall? They strip him of rank. They, I don't know, make him a guardian in the colonies, or just do something bad to him. Just pick your poison, right? But I mean, all of these things that keep happening at this household, how much bullshit is going to be put up with? And it, like, she just added to that, you know, in his mind, he's like, oh, was, you know, Serena didn't help at all today because I had to have her, you know, pinky cut off, or half of her pinky cut off, because she's sitting here reading the Bible in front of all the commanders in the district. So I think you're right. I think they're just going to have to, but it'll be scary and interesting still to see how he decides to punish everybody in the house, because I think he's going to find some level of culpability in everybody, mm-hmm. right? Even Serena.
Yeah. Speaking of Serena, we get to the point now where Serena comes out and confronts June, and she wants June to give her back her baby. June pleads with Serena, saying she can't grow up here. She can get her out. June encourages her to allow her to take Holly away from Gilead. And Serena acquiesces, and she asks if she can hold her so she can say goodbye. And this was a way for them to toy with us, like, you know, once Holly's in her arms, like, she could just turn and run away with the baby. But she didn't do that. she starts to say goodbye to the baby, and she starts to say, "May the Lord shine down on you." And it got grueling for me, you know. She just kept going on with these lines, and, you know, and it was just like, come on, may the Lord rain down on you with fairy kisses. Like, she just kept going on, it seemed like. And it was like, oh my God, shut up, give the baby back. But she does more than just give the baby back. She actually allowed, because June could have taken the baby from her and then handed up to the Martha and then climbed up there. But Serena met her halfway. June climbs up and then Serena hands her Holly. So that's more than just June taking the baby away. That's more than Serena just allowing her to take the baby away. She's actually aiding her.
So in the very final scene that we get with Serena in this season, she finally has had the straws have broken the camel's back. Finally, we've gotten there. And just, I don't want to say that, you know, it's all going to be happiness and flowers from her. I'm sure she's going to act in ways that we're not going to be approving of next season, no matter what. But she finally gets that little bit of, she sees a little bit of agency, something that she can do that is actually good, and she does it. So good for her. I mean, it goes a little bit of a way, at least, to erase some of the stuff that she's done, I would imagine. I don't know. I don't know if I'm just speaking for myself on that one, but the cynical side of me wondered how much the whatever drugs she was on from the anesthetic or whatever.
Oh my God, that better not come into play. Bullshit on that.
Had to do with it, you know. I mean, I'm kind of just trying to be, you know, a little bit funny with it, not really thinking it. But I mean, when she wakes up and gets the drugs are out of her system, she's like, oh my God, what did I do? Too late, but of course.
It may happen. So that Martha that was there with June leads her through some backyards to another Martha. And June crawls through a chain link fence to join this Martha. And they run through some more backyards. And then she's brought to another Martha who leads her yet again to another Martha. June at this point has to run across the street to meet this final Martha. And we have her juxtaposed against the fire behind her, seeing her silhouette. And I thought that this was clever of this network because, you know, having all these Marthas divide up their contribution to this effort, it's a way for them to not be missing too long from their households.
Yeah, yeah.
Though I thought the last Martha had, like, the toughest. She was gone probably the longest and, you know, probably had, hopefully, a cooler commander to work for so she can explain where she was. But anyway, with this final Martha, they walk through tall grasses and they arrive roadside near a tunnel. This Martha departs and tells June to wait and says, Godspeed. So June waits and she pulls out her picture of Hannah. And we have a flashback to where she's singing a song to Hannah and Hannah's giggling every time she touches her nose. And she shows Holly Hannah's picture and she says, maybe you'll meet her one day. And then she says, you're going to meet her one day. So you could maybe infer that she has made the decision here. But I wonder if she had to see Emily. I don't think she would have just handed Holly off to anybody. She didn't know who was coming. Didn't even know if anybody was coming.
I feel like that was the necessary mechanics of it, was for her to see Holly. I believe you're absolutely right about that. So she couldn't really have...
See Emily, you mean?
To see Emily, yeah. When she saw Emily, that was the like you said, that's what fell into place in her mind. Mm-hmm. She knew then that she could hand off Nicole to Emily and still stay in Gilead and go search for Hannah. But I felt like I don't know how I knew, and I think there's a lot of people, when we get a lot of feedback in, I'm betting dollars to donuts that there's going to be a lot of people who say, yeah, I knew once that picture came out, she was going to, you know, she was going to be gone, or she was going to stay. And I felt that way too. I was just like, you know what? The flashback is really what did it. She pulls out the picture, then the flashback. And I was like, oh crap. There's going to be something that's going to make her stay. And it was just a matter of how they got there. And then Emily was the link.
A vehicle pulls up and flashes its light. We know Cora's driving, so she would have done that. June sees Emily being dropped off. And Emily asks, what is happening? And Commander Lawrence says he's getting himself in deep shit. And June says, you're getting out. You're getting out of Gilead. Another vehicle arrives and Commander Lawrence says, they're all yours now. Have a nice life. Don't get caught. Keep away from drugs.
That's the part that I talked about earlier where I said Commander Lawrence made me laugh out loud. It gets funnier every time I watch it. It's just keep away from drugs. Like, what? You know, okay, thanks.
Yeah, I want to watch The West Wing now because he's in it. I've never seen The West Wing. So, but again, June takes her damn time. Even Emily's like, hurry up.
I was wanting Emily to just kind of step halfway out of the van, grab June by the bonnet, and pull her bodily, not hurting the baby, but just pull her as quick as she could into the truck. Get your fucking ass in here and let's go.
Quit mugging.
Yeah. Who do you think is looking at you besides me right now? Why are you keep doing that?
But instead, June gives Holly to Emily and says, call her Nicole. Tell her I love her. June then slams the vehicle door shut, bangs on it to let the driver know to take off. She puts her hood on, and she is now turned to the dark side. Burning Down the House begins to play by the Talking Heads. And that's the cue to let us know that she is going to be fucking shit up. Has to be Burning Down the House. And, you know, another thing I noticed on this third viewing was that before when you're like thinking, hurry up, she's looking at Commander Lawrence's vehicle pull away and her eyes are kind of like squinting, like she's thinking of something. So I think she's already thinking of contacting him first from this point, like building up a connection with him somehow.
Okay.
Like she could use him.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's a great idea. I mean, I've been like for the last couple of days just racking my brain trying to figure out how the opening of season 3 would make this scene okay. Like where we're going to go from there that would make this all right, because this has up until this point 98% of this episode has been just aces, you know, as good as you can expect from a Handmaid's Tale episode, better in some cases, and then this happens.
Yeah. When I first saw this, I was really upset that she didn't leave. I've been so invested this whole season and last season, her getting out of Gilead. I just started getting more and more opposed to the idea of seeing her still there as we go on in the show. So, you know, I got to work and I talked to somebody who watches the show as well. And she has two daughters. And when she watched it, she cried. And she said that she would have done the same thing. She said, I would have absolutely done that. I would not leave my other one behind.
Okay. You know, I'm not a mother, obviously. And so I have no experience to draw from on anything that would be any kind of similar to that. So all I can go on is what, you know, people are saying about stuff like that. And we, you know,
but we talked about our cats, you know, which I know is not the same thing for people, but I mean, we love our cats like they're our children, and I would not leave one of my cats behind anywhere and only save the other.
It's all situational, though, because the intention here is for June to save Hannah somehow, right? That's obviously it.
We know she has no agency in Gilead, so you would think maybe she would have it elsewhere, but we have also seen that Luke and Moira are running in place. They have no ability to help. So why would June?
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. It's a great point. They are able to get almost nothing done. And all they've really been able to do is take the letters that Nick smuggled into the country and post them on the internet to get everybody even more riled up than they were, which served. That was something because it served the Canadian government. But, you know, Nick was the agency there. So it wasn't them. So they haven't been, you know, like the American consulate there was able to give them the best advice possible. Show up to protest. Yay. So I get that. I get that. But as a handmaid in Gilead, you have even less agency than that. So take their impotency to do anything towards a problem and knock it down about a dozen notches. And that's where you're at inside of Gilead. So as a handmaid, that's the caveat. So if they can get her into like one of these areas on the map that he was looking at that's not completely controlled, they can get her in close association with Lawrence. They can do whatever. I have a couple of one or two little pet theories that we'll talk about next week on the when we cover all of the feedback and kick around some ideas about, you know, whatever. And just I think it's going to be a big cathartic session for all of our listeners to let out their rage and frustration at this, because I don't just listening or looking at some of the feedback that we've gotten so far. Not too many people are like, yeah, that ended how I wanted it to. So
you're right. She has less agency, but the one advantage she does have is proximity. Mm-hmm. And she also has a lot more knowledge about the inner workings of Gilead. And it looks like she also has a new ally in Commander Lawrence. So I wonder if like, seeing him maybe was part of her decision-making process there, too.
I hope so. I hope you're right about that. Because as far as her getting out in the novel, we know that she eventually leaves Gilead. We know that because of the voiceovers, and they're staying true to the how that happens in the novel. So the novel runs pretty much bookend to bookend with the first season. Then they take Atwood's premise and they go further at the beginning of the second season. They make you think that she escapes. She doesn't really, but then she does, and she doesn't really get out of Gilead. She spends the time at the globe. So it's this big dangling thing that was just like, oh, and then we're back at the Waterford household for the duration of the season. She has a golden opportunity to leave, and she passes it up willingly. So the one silver lining I could see for this is that she did this of her own accord. So when we keep throwing around the word agency, she actually used some in this situation.
Right.
We just don't like what she did.
We don't like her decision.
Right. But that's what free will boils down to. You make decisions that other people don't like. And you now have to live with them. And so she's decided that doing this is going to be better. You know, the cynical side of me always thinks about how successful the show's going to be going forward. And, you know, we know they're going to have a season 3, but then the article that you talked about last podcast about how they were saying, oh, this could go for 10 seasons. Nobody's going to watch a show that goes for 10 seasons if we keep thinking that June is going to get out of Gilead and she doesn't. It's going to start to be Gilligan's Island after a while. And that is a bad, bad trap to fall into. And it is a hard, hard thing to write yourself out of. I don't care how good your writers are. Eventually, and the problem isn't going to rely on how good or bad your writers are. It's going to rely on how much people give a fuck anymore about watching the show. That's where I don't want to see the show go. And it may not be heading in that direction. Season 3 could just come in and kick ass and take names, and it'll be super awesome. And they come up with these great ideas, which I'm hoping and kind of thinking they will do, but going forward from there, if it turns into Gilead Island, you know, I just don't think you're going to start hitting the law of diminishing returns real quick on that. So there's my concern. And like I said, I'm going to leave my thoughts on that here and let you say what you want to. But
well, you know, as far as season 3, all I know is from the interview I read with Bruce Miller is that we're going to see more of the colonies, and it's going to be different colonies than what we saw this season. At least that's the impression I got. And we're going to see more of Jezebel's.
Oh, okay. That'll add it. Wow.
I don't want to. I'm hoping it's not going to be through June's POV at Jezebel's. That would really upset me to see her there. I don't want to see anybody there, but hopefully she's managing to survive on the fringes somehow with the aid of Commander Lawrence and Cora.
Right.
I'm worried about Rita. I'm worried about Nick. But but because of what I said and what I think about Commander Waterford, I don't think their punishment's going to be fatal. I don't think Aunt Lydia's dead.
What if giving the baby away comes to light and Serena gets put into Jezebel's?
I mean, that could happen. But since you brought up Nicole, so I should start calling her Nicole now. I just wanted to wait till I got to the moment that June decided that. I'm wondering, you know, how much that's going to play as far as like politics. If, you know, since she's going over the border and Emily's going to say this baby is named Nicole, and Commander Waterford's going to put up a big stink about how his baby was kidnapped and now in Canada, and it's going to cause some problems maybe between Gilead and Canada. And that will be really interesting actually to see. And then Luke's going to know that it's June's baby.
Yeah.
And then he's going to get connected to Emily somehow because of it, because he knows Commander Waterford is the one who has June, because he learned that back when Commander Waterford and Serena were in Canada.
Yeah. That will add another layer of drama and intrigue to it. But I think at the end of the day, what they told Fred at the airport when they said, you're no longer welcome here, I don't think anything's changed for them enough to where they would entertain the notion of. But see, it wouldn't matter if they entertained that notion, because I think like what you're saying is it would just add enough that Fred would be getting on to like an international stage and demanding that
happen. Right.
So that would be enough to impel the story forward.
We shall see. Like we announced on our last podcast, we are not going to be reading feedback on this episode. We will be following up with a feedback podcast next week. So if you're still thinking about writing in and haven't done so yet, have your feedback into us by Tuesday. July 24th. Let us know how you felt about this episode, this entire season, and what are your predictions for what's up, what's coming up? Is Aunt Lydia alive? What will be the implications of taking Nicole across the border? Do you think there will be any at all? Well, how much of Emily? Is she going to be relegated to a guest star as Samira Wiley has? And speaking of, we've had Emmy nominations and Handmaid's Tale has been nominated for a lot of categories. Elizabeth Moss has been nominated. Yvonne Strahovski has been nominated, as well as Anne Dowd. Samira Wiley was nominated as a guest star of The Handmaid's Tale.
Huh. So yeah. she's guest star status? I mean, yeah. I guess she's not in it enough, but yeah. So. All right. So we will be back next week to read feedback and deal with everybody's speculations. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
Don't let the bastards
grind you down.
Stay away from drugs.